Morning, everybody. And welcome to the morning after the solstice. The winter solstice was about 13 hours ago. And today we're going to have 8 hours, 46 minutes, and a few extra seconds of daylight. And those of us, as you know, who live in the north are really into this. We really notice the amount of daylight in the year. And although we never grumble. Never. Never. So, and not to take you out of the present moment or anything, but at the summer solstice, I looked it up, 15 hours and 36 minutes of daylight. So, 15 years ago, I gave a talk right around the time of the winter solstice, and I want to revisit just a couple of things that I said back then in the beginning here. I think it's not a coincidence that there are a lot of celebrations at this time of year that have to do with light. First of all, I love that in early December we have our longest Sesshin, our longest retreat of the year, which is Rohatsu Sesshin, that celebrates Buddha's enlightenment. And when did it happen? When the morning star arose in the dark sky. Rohatsu was always my favorite Sesshin because, you know, you start out in the morning and you're sitting there and it's dark. So it's very mysterious, sort of. And then as the sun comes up, there's usually snow outside and it's sort of extra bright. And then in the evening, you're sitting in the dark again. And there's just something about that sitting in the dark that's really wonderful. There's also the Jewish Festival of Lights, Hanukkah, that happens this time of year in remembrance of the one day's supply of oil for the temple lamp that by miraculous means lasted for 8 days. Christmas, at the end of Advent, when the three wise men saw the Star of Bethlehem and followed that bright star to the manger. Hindus have a 5-day holiday this time of year called Diwali that's marked by displays of lamp lighting and colorful lights. And then, of course, there's the solstice, which is the grandmother of them all, that's celebrated by people from the beginning of time. And probably sparked a lot of the winter celebrations that we have now with all the lights things. It's interesting to me that light is usually seen as good and darkness is what we naturally kind of want to avoid. We do that a bit in Buddhism when we talk about relative and absolute. You know, relative being the everyday world of distinctions and differences includes, you know, work and striving and stress and sorrow and all that stuff that makes up our lives. And absolute being sort of the big unknowable world that's beyond our distinctions and our discriminations. And usually light is the metaphor for the absolute. And dark is the metaphor for the relative, but I like to also turn it around because in the light, you can see everything around you, you know, which leads all too often to making assumptions and distinctions about things, thinking that because we can see the shape of things, we know all about them. Think about the difference between walking into a light room and walking into a dark room. You walk into the light room and you go, there's Steve. I know all about Steve, right? Here he is, my old buddy. And so I don't have to think about it too much. But on the other hand, you walk into that dark room and all you see is these kind of shadows and you're not making things up. I was reading this book yesterday and I found a little part where she talks about something very similar. It's called The Library Book by Susan Orlean. And she says, sometimes it's harder to notice a place that you think you know well. Your eyes glide over it, seeing it, but not seeing it at all. it's almost as if familiarity gives you a kind of temporary blindness. I had to force myself to look harder and try to see beyond the concept that was so latent in my brain. So, when you think you know it well, it's all too easy to think I know everything about it. When you can see the whole shape around it, it's all too easy to think I know about that and not have to think about it more deeply. But in the dark, on the other hand, we have don't-know mind. You know, when there aren't any visual cues, our other senses take over, and we might experience everything that's around us in a new way. Have any of you ever been in absolute darkness? You know, the kind you can't see your hand in front of your face kind of darkness? It's an amazing thing. The first time I was ever in absolute darkness was at Alcatraz, when it was a tourist attraction. they'll let you go into the what's it called, the solitary confinement room, and they close that door and you can't see anything. And another time, a little bit happier time, we were up north somewhere and we took a walk in the evening, and when we came back it was pitch black outside, and we're walking down this path, and I actually put my hand up just to see if it really was that dark, and it really was that dark. I couldn't see anything. I remembered that the path was really straight, and there were bushes on both sides so that you couldn't go too far astray. But after I got done being really scared, it was amazing, you know. It was amazing. I think all your other senses kind of take over. And you experience what you're in the middle of in a completely new way. So thinking about all that this week reminded me of the eclipse of the moon that we had last January. It was a supermoon, if you remember, which means that it's very close to the Earth, so it looked enormous. And I remember how cold it was that night. And I had a really hard time talking my husband into going outside and across the street into the park so that we could look at it. And he was absolutely right. It was way too cold to be out. So we only went out for about 15 minutes. And when we got outside, it was pretty close to being to totality in the eclipse. And there's something about seeing that shadow on the moon that made me see something that I hadn't ever really noticed before. I hadn't ever really seen the moon as it is. You know, without thinking about it, I'd always thought of it as this sort of flat disk. I'd always thought of it as two-dimensional. You know, I know it's an orb, you know, and I remember watching Neil Armstrong walk on the moon back in 1969. But somehow it wasn't until that eclipse last January that I realized that even though my brain knows it's an orb, what I always see is this flat thing. You know, like that old Dean Martin song, is it going? When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. I always saw the moon as a big pizza pie. But anyway, being able to see, you know, when there's a partial moon, and you sometimes you can see the dark part as an orb, but the bright part I've never seen as an orb before. So this time I could see the bright part of the moon as being this orb. And the best part is that, you know, even now when I look at the full moon, I still see it as flat, but I remember what it was like to see that orb. And I know in a visceral way that it's an orb, even though it doesn't ordinarily look that way to me. It was, I want to be clear about this. This was not an enlightenment experience. It was just, interesting and funny to me that my brain knew one thing, but I'd always seen something else and never even thought about it. But it did. This whole year, I kind of went around noticing things like that, that I see and I think of one way, knowing that they're really not. And seeing that eclipse also made me more fully appreciate the way that the moon is used as a metaphor for awakening or enlightenment in Zen. You know, we have lots of stories, old stories about monks and nuns practicing diligently for years, you know, and they're hoping to have some kind of a breakthrough. Maybe they're working on a koan or something, and they're really hoping for this breakthrough, and they're feeling usually kind of discouraged, you know, and they'll never really understand. And then they'll see the moon maybe reflected in a bucket of water, and poof, something will happen. Or the bottom of the pail will fall out. One of my favorite of those stories, the bottom of the pail falls out and the water splashes everywhere, and in every little droplet the nun could see the moon, and it just took her up and turned her around, and she had that moment of awakening, that moment of clear seeing. And that moment changes them, and it stays with them even after they've returned to their sort of mundane life of chopping wood and carrying water. We use a lot of metaphors in Zen because, I think, there are experiences and things in the world that we can't really describe. And when we first start this practice, and way into it actually, and even now, what we really see is the finger pointing to the moon. And that's another one of those metaphors, you know, that means it's easy to mistake the teachings for the thing that you're supposed to be looking at. So you look at somebody points to the moon, and what you look at is the finger instead of the moon itself. I tried this out on my grand puppy and on a bunch of different things. Look at that over there, Darby. What does Darby look at? She looks at the finger. And in the metaphor, that's the finger is supposed to guide you towards enlightenment, and it's not supposed to be enlightenment itself, but it's a very easy thing to mistake. The poem on the front of your bulletin today is by Rionin Geisho, a 17th century Japanese nun. And it goes, "This is the 66th autumn I have seen. The moon still lights my face. Don't ask me about the meaning of Zen teachings. Just listen to what the pines and cedars say on a windless night." So Rion Geisho is one of the ancestors whose names we chant every Saturday morning here at MCMC during our morning service. And I can hardly say Rion Geisho. I want to go Rion Geisho, Daiyosho. You know, it's one of those names. And this poem caught my attention because I've seen 66 autumns myself now. And the moon still lights my face, I hope. When I saw that line, "the moon still lights my face," to me, that means that she's still inspired even more deeply all the time by her practice. And the third line, "don't ask me about the meaning of Zen teachings," to me, appreciate your life. You know, appreciate your life. Just do the practice one foot in front of the other. One foot in front of the other. And what a great last line. "Just listen to what the pines and cedars say on a windless night." That's the kind of line I think maybe shouldn't be explained. You know, if it seems obscure, that's okay. You know, maybe just if it's something that stays with you, maybe just sit for half an hour or 45 minutes at night and then go out for a walk in the dark. Take a silent walk, take a mindfulness walk, and see what happens. You know, if that line inspires you, you know, take it up as a koan. And if you're diligent and you're paying attention outside, you know, you'll eventually hear what the pines and cedars have to say. Dogen Zenji, the founder of our branch of Zen, talks a lot about rocks and mountains and the trees and the streams as being sentient beings. And I never understood what that meant. Until one time I was walking in a national park, and then all of a sudden it was just so obvious that they were all sentient beings, and I can't explain in words what that was, but it happened, and I went, that foxy old Dogen, you know? We always think he's speaking metaphorically, but I think sometimes he's really speaking literally. I led a retreat in Atlanta a few years ago, and they have one of the busiest airports in the country, maybe the world, I don't know. And I went outside in the morning, and I looked up in the sky, and there were all these vapor trails, and the sky was actually plaid. I couldn't believe it. I came inside, and I said, you guys, the sky is plaid. Look at all those vapor trails. And they're all like, ho-hum, that's the airport. And I said, no, you know, if Dogen wrote about this, everybody would be, there he is again, talking about, you know, plaid skies, when in fact, really what he saw was this plaid sky, where all of his monks and nuns were going, ho-hum, that's just the airport. Here's another poem. This one's a gatha by Robert Aitken. We have one of his gathas down in our bathroom, if you notice it sometime. But this is one of his other gathas. Hearing the crickets at night, I vow with all beings to touch and receive and convey the mind of rivers and stars. So, a gatha is a short poem that has a very particular form. And he has a whole book of them called The Dragon Who Never Sleeps, Verses for Zen Buddhist Practice. And I go back to this thing over and over again. So the first line in this gatha, hearing the crickets at night, it always describes what's going on in the world right now. You know, in this case, it's hearing the crickets at night. And in his book, every one of them is, you know, when geckos cry in the attic, or when people show anger and malice, when I bow to my sisters and brothers, when federal taxes are due, when the army holds a parade, when, you know. So the first sentence is always something in the real world. And then the second line is a declaration of a vow. And he gets it just right the way he says, I vow with all beings. That's exactly what the second line of each one of these is. I vow with all beings. And the all beings is important because, you know, we're never really alone in our actions. We're never really alone. And also, every vow that we ever take has reverberations, you know, that ripple to all the other people that are around us and all the people who are around them. And they reverberate out in ways that we can't understand or predict or foretell. In his introduction, he says, everything is affected each time I make a move here in the grand net of the universe. And as I rediscover my own Buddha nature, my vows are naturally the vows of Buddha, that all beings be freed from their anguish. So, he's taking these vows with all beings. And the last two lines are the aspiration or the intention or the action that he's going to take. In this case, hearing the particular, hearing the crickets at night, that's the relative world. And then sometimes the action that he's going to take is kind of mundane, but other ones like this, to touch and receive and convey the mind of rivers and stars, it's the absolute. You know, it reminds us that if we widen our view, you know, we'll see that we're part of a much larger cosmos. And we can't exactly convey the sounds of those crickets. You know, if you've never heard a cricket at night, I can't explain to you what it sounds like. And we can't convey the experience of hearing the sound of, or hearing the words of the pines and the cedars at night. All we can do for other people is be fingers pointing to the moon. And I noticed this morning that we have four moons in our Zendo, which I think is kind of an auspicious thing. I never noticed that before. But anyway, we can't describe those things, but we can touch the mind of the moon and the stars. You know, we can receive them with gratitude and appreciation and awareness, and do what we can to live our lives with others in a way that conveys whatever that experience has taught us. And the entryway to all of that is, of course, Zazen, which I can't explain it, but I promise you it's true. You know, there's just something about Zazen, and every Dharma talk, at least every one I've ever given, is really just about encouraging everyone to meditate and examine our lives. You know, you may be surprised at how your mind can settle down. The first thing you'll be surprised by is how noisy, you know, your mind is. You'll see that in a way that a lot of times kind of freaks people out. You know, I spent an entire sitting one time redoing an Excel spreadsheet. And it wasn't until the bell rang that I went, oh, I didn't come out of it that whole time. When we do retreats here, that's the one thing that I hear from people most often is, my mind is just so full. It's always, always talking. And and the thing that's hard to really convey to people is that that's okay. You just keep sitting, and at some point you'll start to hear the silence in between the words or in between the cells and rows of your Excel spreadsheet, if that's what you're doing. And you'll begin to hear the silence that's underneath those words. And your mind can settle down. And that's when life just becomes a whole lot more interesting. You start to notice things like, I've never seen the curvature of the moon before. So we sit like a Buddha every day, and that helps us open ourselves up to the world. And that's really the foundation of Zen practice. So having said all that, I want to go back again to that 15-year-old talk and close with one more verse. And it's really a song, and you probably know it. And it goes like this. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. So, that's it. Thank you. So has anybody else ever spoken personally to the moon? Any questions or anything you want to say?
It's late last night. It's just oppressive now.
Yeah.
It's like 3 or 4 in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really beautiful, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
So, your talk reminded me of program I saw on PBS recently, so likely still on streaming. And it was called Reindeer Family and Me.
The Reindeer Family?
Reindeer Family and Me. And it fits so well with your talk because it was about I think it was a Scottishman who wanted to go see the Northern Lights. And so he went to the very northern reaches of I think it was Norway, or it might have been Finland, but up to the Arctic Circle. And the end goal was to see the Northern Lights. What it became about, though, was the journey, taking the reindeer and going out into the wilderness all by himself, himself and one reindeer, and it became really a story about really bonding with this reindeer in the darkness, because this was in the winter. And literally they had maybe 2 hours of daylight getting out there, and his experience about understanding what the world is in darkness is really what it ended up being about.
So tell me the name of it again. The
Reindeer Family and Me.
Reindeer Family and Me.
It's going to take 1 hour.
It's going to be on again tonight.
Oh.
Oh. It might be, yeah, I was thinking.
So, but if you look at the guy, we saw it and just loved it.
Oh.
It was beautiful.
Wonderful. Huh. I saw the Northern Lights over Lake Superior one time. And I was so startled, and I saw them, and I was really glad that they were over the lake, because if they had been over land, I would have said, you know, it's a light, you know, it's lights at a gas station or something. And the whole time I was looking at them, I was going, this can't be happening. This is not happening. And yet there it was. Yeah. So. Anyway. Yeah.
Because my husband has limited vision, he prefers well-lit rooms. And he's always frustrated by restaurants and places that have dark corners.
Ah.
And it really made me think about why I like those dark corners. And I think it's because, as you said, it's because it's not really right there in front of your face. You don't see all the other people at the other tables and think about what they're doing. You're just focused on your own little area, and you can let go of the rest.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably why they have candlelit services on Christmas Eve, too. You know, it sort of accentuates the holiness that we don't see most of the time all around us. Yeah. Yeah.
When I was driving in on Saturday morning from Minnetonka on Highway 7, a drive I do all the time, there was a hoarfrost that morning.
Oh.
And it was right at sunrise. And it hit it just right. And it was like 5 miles of this corridor of white trees in a winter wonderland. It was just so wondrous.
Yeah.
Inner city, or not inner city, but closer in the north trees anymore. But
yeah.
It was just like being on a long sleigh ride.
Yeah.
So. You know, it's there, it comes any time.
Yeah. At unexpected times. And then it stays with you, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, Jeff.
I think Zazen, excuse my voice, it's not functioning very well this morning, is a deeply instructive practice. My experience is it's not necessary. And the reason I know this is from an experience that I had when I was 7 years old. And my brother and a friend and I were playing in a sandbox in the backyard of the family home. And all of a sudden, this deep sense of peace descended on us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was convinced. My brother spoke, and I thought, I knew he was going to say that. And then Billy spoke, and I thought the same thing. So I think this experience of deep peace is available to us. The thing about Zazen is, I forgot all about that experience until I started doing serious meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it came back to me.
Yeah.
And how stunning that was. So it's always here.
It is always here. And yet, you know, we go through huge portions of our lives just not seeing it at all. It's like or we see people out there walking around the lake, you know, and they'll be talking and eating a sandwich and, you know, listening on their headphones and doing eight other things. And I think, you know, you're going to get all the way around that lake and never see the lake. And, I mean, I've done it myself, you know. And what a shame. So, was there something back here? Somebody back here had their... Yeah.
I had a Buddhist joke.
Oh, cool.
I bring them now and then. Can a Buddhist use email? Yes, as long as there are no attachments.
You never know what virus might be in that attachment. Thank you.